Hello and welcome to Hometown Alaska. Today we're talking with longtime Chugiak large animal veterinarian, Dr. Julie Gross. Julie has been a practicing large animal veterinarian here in Alaska for almost 30 years. And that is a lot of animal practice. So if you have a question, this is your chance to talk to a pro. And if you would like to speak to this person about your horse or your cow, I don't think she'll talk to you about your cow, but she might talk to you about your horse. And that would be done by calling 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide. We can also take questions by email. The address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Julie, welcome and thanks for coming in. It's good to see you after all these years.
Thanks for inviting me, Peter.
Well, it's going to be fun, I think. We're going to have a lot to talk about. And let's start by let's talk about the differences between large animal veterinary, what the practice is, the care is, and small animals. What's the difference between the two? We talked a little bit about this before.
Yeah, I primarily take care of horses in my career, and the difference is primarily in the nature of the work. A lot of my work is in the field. I go out almost every day to different farms and barns to look at horses. Versus the other side of the house in our practice sees all their patients in-house. Everything comes to them. And so I spend a lot of time driving, but I'm also outside every day, and that's probably the best part.
Except on days like this when the wind is blowing and stuff.
I'm very happy to be in here today with you.
Well, that's good. I'm happy to have you. Let's see. So what things should people be doing to button their horses up for the winter now? What sort of things should they be doing to take care of their animals?
Single most important thing for winter care for horses in Alaska is providing a fresh source of unfrozen water.
Water is more than shelter?
More so than anything. They must have a fresh, frozen, unfrozen source of water. And they actually prefer warm water and will drink more water when it's warm than if it's a little bit cool. So providing heaters in the water tanks is vital. But a horse really needs water, and he actually loses a fair bit of water, for instance, on a day like today. Because we tend to feed them a little bit more in the winter to help them stay warm, which is also important, they need more water to process that food.
So how much water would that be, like for an average horse, if there is such a thing?
Most horses are going to drink around 10 gallons of water per day, up to 15, maybe even 20 gallons. But probably 10 to 15 would be average for most horses.
So the vets are sitting around, just like the doctors, and saying, you got to get your 8 to 10 glasses of water every day.
Exactly.
But if your horse got to drink 10 to 15 gallons?
Yeah. Yeah,
man, that's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water. And so if you're carrying it in a bucket, it's really a lot of water.
Yep. But I guess that's part of what being a horse owner is about, is taking care of the animals. In
exactly.
some ways, it's not like having a dog or something like that where you can do the minimum and the dog will thrive if you're just careful. You got to really pay attention to
those
big
animals.
There's
a lot of care. I think one of the other things that happens on a really cold day like this is we tend to sit in the house and drink coffee and say, I don't think I'll go to the barn today if you're boarding your horse somewhere. And and it's really important that the horses get out and get a little bit of exercise and movement, even on a cold day, because their intestinal system seems to require a bit of movement to function properly.
Oh, interesting.
So the horses that don't get out much, and especially when it's cold and they don't tend to move around as much themselves, even if they're out in a field, maybe we'll see an increase in the amount of colic, which is abdominal pain in the horse.
Well, so what are the signs of that? How do you know your horse is in distress?
Usually, this time of year, if they're not drinking enough water and not moving around enough, it will be simply that they might not eat as well. Looking at their stomachs, kicking at their belly, maybe laying down at feeding time would be a good sign. Clinical signs of dehydration, you can kind of do a little skin pinch test on your horse, look at his gums, that sort of thing.
So, are there breeds that do better up here, for instance? It seems like if you got an Arabian, that might not be the sort of horse you want to keep up here. Just, it's a desert animal, I would think, in some ways.
Yeah, they are.
Versus an Appaloosa, which is like from the northwest part of the country,
right.
I guess.
I think that there are certainly horses that seem to do a little bit better in that they're a little tougher. The Norwegian Fjord is a great horse for Alaska. But a lot of horses thrive here. I don't think that there's necessarily a breed that I wouldn't bring to Alaska. I think the thoroughbred with a little bit thinner skin and a little thinner hair coat might require a little bit more care, but most horses seem to do just fine, other than their feet. The moisture and the freeze-thaw cycles are pretty hard on the hoof capsule of the horse.
So. Interesting. Yeah. So I'd like to remind our listeners that we are talking with Dr. Julie Gross about large animal veterinary matters, which shows that we talk about just about everything here on KSKA sooner or later. And if you would like to talk to her about your horse, or if you have a question about horses or veterinary practice, please call us at 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752 statewide. Or if you like, you can email us, and that is hometown@alaskapublic.org. So we're anxious to hear from you if you have questions. And in the meantime, let me just ask you about, you've been practicing now for 30 years, and I'm curious if you've seen much in the way of technological changes. That helped you at all?
Oh, tremendously. We've seen the advent of technology in imaging that has just gone beyond our imagination. When I went to veterinary school, an ultrasound machine was this great big box that sat in the storeroom in the radiology department, and they said, well, someday these will be useful. And now we have two of them in our practice.
Wow.
I take one out in the field with me.
So is it like a little app that you hold up on your phone or something like that?
No, I wish.
To scan the horse.
It's a little bigger than that.
Okay.
But the other thing that's changed is radiology. And we used to have just a film that sat in a plate, and we exposed that film and took it back to the office and processed it in a in tanks originally that sat in the spare bathroom in my house. But now we have digital radiography, and so in 20 seconds I can have an image of a horse's foot or his knee or someplace else that I want to look at just standing in the horse's stall.
Amazing.
And so the quality of that image is remarkable as well. So
well, so you're a radiologist as well as like a surgeon in a general practitioner and everything like that. It's like you got to do everything. It's like you wake up and say, today I'm an expert in imaging, or I'm an expert in like orthopedic medicine or something like that. It's what
yes.
you got to cover all those things.
We do. We learn it all. We have to, we do a lot of our own lab work in the clinic, and we do our own radiology, our own surgery. We have our own, we have to provide some pharmacy services, just everything, surgery, medicine, you name it.
So that could be a good thing or a bad thing, I guess. Is this the sort of thing you foresaw when you were becoming a vet, that you'd have to do all these kind of things?
Yes, that has long been the case in veterinary medicine. There are specialists, of course, in veterinary medicine that have become board certified in surgery or medicine, and we have those available here in Anchorage for
really?
Small animals, but not for horses. And so I think the advantage is that when we see your animal, be it a dog, a cat, or a horse, we are going to work through all of the different parameters that need to be taken care of within a very short period of time, because we're going to go from one room to the next and just walk into the radiology. The technician's going to pull blood, and we're going to have the lab results in 20 or 30 minutes versus having to go to the lab and get that done and then go to the radiology department at the hospital. And so we pull our information together a little bit quicker.
So it's more holistic in a lot of ways.
In a lot of ways.
And let me see here. Did you start out very young age deciding that you wanted to be a vet and this was the way to go?
I did. I think I was about 14 when I decided that I really wanted to be a veterinarian. I grew up in Anchorage and I had horses as a kid, and there weren't very many veterinarians who were even willing to come and look at the horse at that time.
Wow.
And so as a result of having some horses who occasionally had some issues, I had developed a really strong interest. And so, yeah, it's been a long time in a straight line.
Wow. So let me give out the numbers again here in case people are out there with horse questions for you. You can call 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752 statewide. Or again, we have an email address. If you prefer to email us, that's hometown@alaskapublic.org. If you're thinking about acquiring a large animal, which in our case is pretty much horses we're talking, what are the things you need to think about when you want to do that?
I think the first thing to do is make sure that you have a good place to keep the horse, and that you've thought that out, and be it boarding a horse at one of the facilities around, or that you have adequate space to keep a horse at your own property. And then when you're considering buying a horse, I think it's very important to seek some advice with regard to the condition of that horse and its suitability for your intended purpose, as well as having it checked for some health issues. Lameness is a big deal, and that changes what you intend to do with the horse pretty quickly if there's a lameness problem. And so it's a good idea to kind of find out what the baseline is of that horse before you purchase it. So we do exams called purchase exams, where we go through the horse kind of with a fine-tooth comb and see what there is to find. And that doesn't always, it very seldom results in not buying the horse, but at least then you know what areas to keep an eye on.
And it's not like you can take it to a mechanic and get it fixed. It's like you got to just, once you buy the horse, you got to sort of figure out what's wrong and address it yourself.
You do have to deal with what you have, and it may mean that you change what you intended to do with the horse. Mm-hmm. My goal for my patients is as long of a pain-free, useful life as possible.
Mm-hmm. And a useful life would be whatever the person is trying to do with the horse, if they want it for jumping, or what are the things people do get horses for?
Oh, mostly in our area, pleasure, just trail riding, enjoying the horse, some arena work. There are a lot of show horses in our community, and the biggest portion of those seem to be jumping horses. We have a lot of dressage folks. And
Hold it. What's dressage?
Dressage is a discipline of riding that was developed in Europe probably originally as war horses, and they learned to do very specific moves that originally had application in the war field. But today it's a very beautiful combined training of the horse and rider that is a lifelong effort.
Is that an Olympic sport?
It is.
Yeah, okay, so that's the sort of thing you see on the Olympics where the horses are sort of dancing around and stuff.
Correct.
I saw a hilarious video the other day, which was of a horse dancing to this rap song, and it was like there was all this foul language and all the people. I don't know if it was the actual if they dubbed in the music later and the horse was dancing something completely different, but it was sort of a weird combination of things, this aristocratic looking horse and this sort of down and funky music. So that was I guess it's a little like figure skating where they have the music and that's supposed to...
They do. There's an event called Musical Cur that is an Olympic sport. Most dressage competition is not to music, but there is an event that is a musical cur, and it is set to music. And actually, these days, music is actually written for specific horses at the top of the...
So they have their own composers. That's just amazing. People think horses are so special. That's one of the things that's really interesting is... And one of the things that I don't... it's just one of those mystery things. Why does a person connect with horses or dogs or cats? Or I don't know if you have any thoughts about that as a vet, but it's just interesting how some people are dog people, some people are cat people.
It's true. I certainly have an affinity for horses. I think there's something about a horse that's just very inspiring. They're a beautiful animal. They're so strong, yet they're fragile. They can provide so much enjoyment, both from an exercise standpoint as well as just being with them. I think one of my favorite things to do is sit in a barn and listen to horses eat.
It's sort of interesting because they have this sort of, we've got relationships with animals, for instance, dogs, cats, and horses. They're different than our relationships with other animals. I think I would put those three, I think, in a, maybe goats you could throw in there too. Some people do keep goats as pets and they have a certain affinity for goats. But there's just something about those three categories of animal that people seem to connect with somehow. And horses just have this sort of...
Some people think horses are a little more like cats. They're a little more aloof. And, you know, your dog is always happy to do something for you and just be there and get your paper for you or whatever he does. But a horse is not there to do things for you. But he certainly enjoys, I think, being ridden and doing things that some horses love to jump, and you can just, they get so excited when they go. And other horses just seem to really like to get out in the field and be free to gallop, and even with their rider. And they certainly appreciate dinner time.
Yeah.
So, but I think we get a lot of enjoyment out of watching them. They're a big, powerful animal. They've been part of the history of the world. I think has been greatly influenced by the horse.
In what ways?
Horses have been used for centuries, both as work animals, as well as food, as well as companionship.
And, as food.
Some studies even in America early on, there were horses that were used for food. But certainly in the East, horses were definitely a food animal for a while. I guess they still are in parts of the world. But
I guess if you're a cougar, it's definitely food.
Sure.
For humans.
They've evolved really to mostly a pet, and certainly an industry in the race industry, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. In many parts of the world, the horse is still a work animal, and large numbers of horses throughout the world pull carts and work in fields, and that is still their primary function.
I can remember reading about when the horse was the main mode of transportation for a lot of before the automobile, and people have the descriptions of the horse manure being like inches deep on the streets of New York and places like this.
Yeah, I can't really imagine that.
It's hard to imagine it, but it is apparently the way it was back when. Was there would be people would have so many horses that, and they would use them for hauling things, mm-hmm. and they would have like wagons and stuff like that. And it was just the horse was always, I guess, sort of a part of our, as a country, it's kind of a part of our legend of the West and all that, and how the West was won. And
yeah, my grandfather had horses and carriage horses, and his family had farm horses and mules as well. And I have many, many photographs of the family farm and all the work horses. It was essential. My dad told me that the horses had all died of encephalitis, and so they went to Missouri and bought mules because they were the word was they were a little bit more resistant, and so they moved from horses to mules at one point. But that was
a mule is
essential.
Is a cross between horse and donkey, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's my one little bit of equine knowledge, I guess. So do you see donkeys and mules as well as horses in
your
practice?
We see a few. There aren't that many in our mm-hmm. practice. I couldn't tell you how many for sure, but not very many. And they mm-hmm. are different.
They are.
They have very different temperaments. And so if you're not accustomed to working around them, it can be a little challenging. It is a little bit challenging for me to work around a mule.
So that's the famous mulish personality is like stubborn as mule. Is that what you're talking about, or is it?
Yeah, they are. Definitely.
So what's an example of that, or can you think of one off the top of your head?
Oh, probably a mule that comes to the hospital for some sort of routine work and just trying to get him back in the trailer. Uh-huh. It really has to be his idea, or he's not going back in there.
Okay, that's interesting. So how do they stay out? What do? They just refuse to
move. Yeah, they just don't move.
That's when you get the 2x4, I guess.
Yeah, no, that doesn't work.
Okay. Well, that's,
you just have to wait for the mule to decide that
that's what he wants
there.
To do, yeah.
Or you get some sort of, you know, the person who owns the mule usually has some sort of insight into what will convince
right.
the mule, and mm-hmm. it's sort of a mystery.
So do they have insight into why they have a mule? Is it just, it's like some people are mule people and some people are horse people, like we were talking about dog people?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Huh. Well, to get back to education, there's a question I wanted to ask about. It's almost as much, it's that we talked a little bit about this earlier, and you don't have to do residencies and internships, but it's almost as much as becoming a doctor for humans.
Yes. For instance, I spent 8 years in college. I did an undergraduate degree and then 4 years in veterinary school. Some veterinary schools can be finished in 3 years, but I think they go throughout the year and they don't have a summer break.
Uh-huh.
Beyond that, you can do an internship for a year and then a residency for however long it takes and become a specialist in a given field. They're board-certified surgeons and internal medicine and ophthalmology and that sort of thing, and that would then certainly take additional years. But most of us that practice in veterinary medicine have taken those 4 years as a veterinary school to then have the degree and then sit for the boards to be able to get a license to practice in any given state.
So that's 4 years to become a radiologist, a surgeon, a general practitioner, and a little bit. And it just seems like at that point, why take care of animals? Why not take care of people if you're going to go to all that effort?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it boils down to whether you're a people person or an animal person, or where your interests lie. I think for almost every veterinarian, at a certain point after veterinary school, you stop and think, well, maybe I should go back and go to medical school.
Mm-hmm. Is that common? Or
I think there are a few that do mm-hmm. that. And I think the reasons that we ponder that and consider doing so is that there is a lot more available from a technology standpoint and from a care standpoint on the human side than there is on the veterinary side, and money is not an issue. Often some of the decisions that are made in veterinary medicine are based on economics, and on the human side it's certainly less so because of insurance and other kinds of care. And so we ponder that, whether or not we'd be a little happier doing that kind of medicine where we could do more. But I think it's a difficult decision. I know for myself, I thought, okay, what would I be if I went back to medical school? And pediatrics was at the top of my list. And I thought, well, that's not a lot different than what I do every day now. My patients don't say much.
Right.
And it's pretty hard to get out of them what really is going on.
Exactly.
So really, what's different?
That was a question I was going to ask you. It must be terribly frustrating if you don't. There's got to be like five or six main things that go wrong with a horse all the time, and you can just look at the horse and say, okay, this horse has got colic or whatever. But if it's something off-beat or off-brand, then how do you take the horse's history? I suppose at that point you have to depend somewhat on the owner's ability to tell you what the horse is doing differently and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think the history is really important. There are days when I feel like I'm just Sherlock Holmes, because it's all about detective work and trying to figure it out. And so we have tests that we go through, and observation is huge. I think the power of observation and being able to just stand back and watch what's happening, particularly in a lameness situation, is really important. And then just utilizing the tools that we have.
So I wonder if there's... My aunt was a doctor, and she talked about how people nowadays are so dependent on technology and on having their references and stuff that they don't really do listening like that anymore in human medicine, because they are just used to they become superficial, she thinks, in some ways. And I guess that you can't have that happen in veterinary medicine because your patients aren't talking to you.
Right. I think that because we don't really have access to quite as much. For instance, I would love to have an MRI machine and be able to, that would solve almost all my problems from a lameness standpoint if I could get that information, but I don't really have that available to me. So I do still rely a lot on observation and history and just the physical things that I can do to determine what might be wrong.
Mm-hmm. So are there lessons for human doctors, you think, in veterinary medicine?
I think there are, and I think that there's a lot of research that is shared between the two fields. Mm-hmm. I've just returned from a meeting in Florida that had to do specifically with problems of the horse's foot, and I know we're borrowing a lot of data from the human side in research with regard to actually type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance.
Wow, so horses can get diabetes.
They seldom develop full-blown diabetes, but they have hyperinsulinemia and a resistance to insulin.
And that's type 2. Is that the type from eating too much, or is that the type
from overeating and obesity? And in the horse, it develops into laminitis or foundering, which is a devastating, crippling disease of the horse.
And foundering is what? It's when their back goes?
The foot. The bonds that hold the hoof wall to the foot break down, and in the worst case scenario, the last bone in the foot can come through the bottom of the horse's foot.
Wow, that's amazing. Mm. I guess that would be, that's a career ending injury for a horse, or is that?
In that event, it is. In the event that the horse has, if we can identify very early that the horse has a tendency toward having a high level of insulin, there are things we can do to slow that down and reverse it and then save the hoof structure. But there's no foot, no horse, as
wow.
Incredibly true.
Uh-huh. So I'd like to remind people that we are talking with Dr. Julie Gross, a longtime equine veterinarian. I guess we'll have to say that she's a large animal veterinarian, but short of any cows in the immediate vicinity, there aren't too much out there besides horses. Do you ever get called on to take care of moose or something like that? Just sort of a off-the-wall question, but I'm trying to think of large animals besides horses.
We have had those calls over the years. we actually had a moose calf in the hospital for a couple of weeks one time whose mother had been hit by a car, and the calf had been hit as well. And Fish and Game gave us permission to keep the calf during its recovery, and it did quite well. And then they had us turn it loose back out into the wild. So that was an adventure. It ate up all the alder from our yard, and they actually like bananas very much.
That's interesting. A moose likes bananas, and how would a moose know it likes bananas unless there were humans involved? That's
I have no idea.
One of those things that you would just, you go through your life knowing something was wrong if you were a moose, that you'd never had a banana, but you wouldn't know what a banana was. It'd be one of those mysteries that they probably have a lot of time to choose their head and think about.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, let me give out those numbers again for people that might want to talk about their horse questions. This is Dr. Julie Gross from the Equine and Small Animal Clinic in Chugiak. And the number here at KSK is 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 888-353-5752 statewide. Or if you like, you can send us an email at hometownalaskapublic.org. So let's move along here, and let's see what we haven't asked yet. There's so much. Is there continuing education requirements for veterinarian, excuse me?
As an Alaska licensed veterinarian, we have a requirement for 30 hours of continuing education every 2 years. And so that's forever, you know, mm-hmm. as long as you keep your license, need to acquire those credits. So you can do that. There's a state meeting of the Veterinary Association, Alaska mm-hmm. Veterinary Medical Association, and they bring people in for lectures every year. And there are meetings all around the world, actually, that you mm-hmm. can go to. And then there's a lot of online education now that you can get credits for.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what are the sort of things that you've looked at recently that have been continuing education things that you've had to do or that you thought would add to your practice?
Yeah, for me, I have a very specific interest and passion for taking care of the horse's foot. It's developed over many years, realizing that's probably the biggest problem.
No horse, no foot.
No horse,
what we said
no foot. And
no foot, no horse, I guess is what it is.
Yeah, and so I tend to go to meetings that focus on that. Mm-hmm. The meeting that I've most recently been to was an international conference on foot care, and sponsored by four different universities, and they bring in people from all over the world. There was an interesting talk at that meeting by a fellow from Australia who had studied the Brumby, the wild horse of Australia, and specifically looking at their feet and from different environments, which was fascinating to me because I think our environment plays a big role in the problems we see.
So the Alaska environment is specifically causing problems for the horse? Is that the snow or the moisture that
I think the moisture and the freeze-thaw cycles have a tendency to change things, as well as the fact that our horses, for the most part, the horses that I care for live in urban areas and don't necessarily have access to large areas to move around in. Mm-hmm. Even so, the horses that are in those areas have different feet than they, for instance, if a horse comes here from another state and after he's been here 6 months or a year, his feet are fairly different than they were when they arrived. And then if that same horse leaves, his feet will change again. So they're very subject to changes in the environment. And so, that was true in Australia in the study mm-hmm. that they did as well. They had vastly differing feet on those horses.
Well, I think we may have some emails here. Let's see. So, what do we got here? Nope, this is just a bogey. Sorry about that. I think it's about time for us to take our midway break. This is Peter Dunlap-Scholl on KSKA's Hometown on 90.5 Anchorage.
Listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage. Thank you.
We're back here at Hometown Alaska with Dr. Julie Gross, a large animal veterinarian. If you have a question for Dr. Gross about your horse, please do call us at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide. And we can also take your questions by email. If you have an email question, just go ahead and send that in to hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I was wondering, do you have any moments where you really realized this is what you got into veterinary medicine for, when you really felt like this is what you wanted to do and you were sort of living the dream of being a vet as you saw it when you were a 14-year-old?
You know, that's evolved a little over the years. When I first started, I was so excited to be doing what I was doing.
It was like every day was that day.
Every day was that day. It was great. And over the years, I've come to realize that the best part of my day is really helping people and providing help for the animal that they love so much, and that there's maybe a problem and that we're solving those problems, or at least finding out what's wrong so that they can have some peace of mind about what's happening. And that interaction with the kids and adults both that have horses is really a big part of my day. I enjoy it a lot.
So there's not any one moment when you've lately, it's more of a general feeling of knowing what you're doing and that it matters.
Yes, I think that it matters a lot. And that horses, I think, are a really important part of many people's lives and help us keep a bit of a balance in today's world.
Well, my wife is a person who is very interested in horses, and that's what she says. That when she goes to the barn, she goes down to Barnsby, what she calls. And her normal day is working at the newspaper, which is a very deadline, one thing after another. But with the horse, she has to go at the horse's speed or else things don't happen the way they're supposed to.
That's true in my world as well. When I get to the barn and I maybe had lots of phone calls and emails through the morning and paperwork to do and records to write, and I get to the barn, I have to change gears totally because that horse picks up right away if I'm not in his speed. So it's
and how does that get manifested? How does the horse let you know that you're not doing what you should be doing?
Usually I'm in a hurry, and if I'm in a hurry, the horse never does what we expect him to do. He's frightened or he gets resistant and doesn't want to do what we have in mind, be it trot around on a circle or have his blood drawn. But if I slow down and just listen to what the horse has to say about the thing, then things go a little better.
Okay, looks like we do have a call here. Dee, you have a question for Dr. Gross?
Yes, I do. I brought a 4-year-old filly up from outside overseas, and she has arrived. She's spending her first winter here, and she has grown about a 1-inch, very fuzzy coat, but has neglected to grow the longer guard hairs yet. And I'm just wondering, she doesn't appear to be cold, especially with this cold weather coming in, but I just wanted to know if it would... it's better just to leave her and let her continue to grow her coat if she can, or to put a lightweight blanket on her?
That's a question I get every week. And I think the answer to that is to let the horse tell you. If the horse is, if she's shivering and cold, then she probably needs some extra protection. Often horses will shiver in the morning before feeding, and as soon as you feed them, they'll stop shivering, and that's pretty normal. The other aspect of that is to monitor the horse's weight, because if they are cold, they're going to burn up a lot more calories staying warm, and they'll start to drop a little weight. So be sure you get your hands on the horse every week and sort of assess where you are as far as maintaining a good body condition.
Okay. And so more hay.
More hay actually provides additional physical heat. It's called the heat increment, and as the horse digests hay, there's actually physical heat that's released internally in their digestive system, and it sort of warms the whole body. And so, yes, more hay is definitely in order, and more frequently throughout the day to kind of maintain that heat. You do have to be a little bit careful in the horse that's the easy keeper. I mentioned hyperinsulinemia earlier. And a lot of hay is actually very high in soluble carbohydrates or simple sugars, which are implicated in causing hyperinsulinemia. And so if the horse is a really easy keeper and it doesn't take much food to keep weight on them, you need to be very careful about the type of hay that you feed them to keep them warm.
Okay. And the best way to check for temperature or whether they're cold or not is there a place that you should, or just visually?
Pretty much visually, and whether the horse seems a bit stressed. If they're shaking or not maintaining weight, I think is probably the most important thing. And so getting your hands on them, making sure that you can maybe feel the last couple of ribs, but there's a fat layer between the skin and the ribs further forward, that there's a nice fat cover over the back and over the shoulders is important.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling in. And we have now a question that's a little bit off your normal path, I think, but if Marie would chime in with her llama question, please.
Hi. Well, I just wondered how suitable llamas were for our climate up here. I know a few people that have them. And if the foot care is the same for llamas as the concerns are the same for llamas as they are for horses.
I don't know very much about llamas. I do know there are a number of them here, and they seem to thrive. Because they have a very different foot type than the horse, I couldn't really speak to that. I think they're okay. I think that they have not the... because it's a cloven hoof, there's a little different mechanical force on the foot, and I don't think we see the same problems. But again, I don't see them often, and so I wouldn't say that I'm aware that there are problems with their feet.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. My aunt used to keep llamas in northern New England, and they would get out and run around. They would jump over their enclosures and stuff and get loose, and there'd be like llamas running loose in the Boston area, which is...
Oh, that's a little exciting.
Yeah, I do know there are people that keep them up here, but you don't see them in your practice, I guess.
We don't. It's a choice, not being familiar with the animal and not knowing the routine husbandry of llamas. We're not comfortable providing veterinary care for them because it's a very special area that actually we're not taught in veterinary school, at the point we went through veterinary school, about llamas. We had to learn many species, but the llama was not one of them.
Uh-huh. That's probably a changing sort of ball game at some point because they're becoming more common, I think, than they were.
I think they did see a rise, and I think veterinary schools began to offer courses to their students to learn more about them, but that wasn't the case 30 years ago.
So I guess that brings up the question of exotic animals, and I think the horse is actually native to North America, isn't that right?
The horse is native to North America. I've been reading about that a little bit lately. Uh-huh. Apparently in Alaska, there were horses here maybe even 7,600 years ago.
So that recently, that's not very long.
And then they disappeared from the North American continent. And
that was the Ice Age that took them out?
Yeah. Well, there's some thought that maybe it was hunting pressure because they disappeared about the same time as the mammoth.
Uh-huh.
And that there's some thought that occurred because of hunting pressure. But there's also some thought that there was a change in the type of grass and the type of forage that was available at that time. And it moved from a more of a lush grass area to grasses that grow in drier climates that have a higher silica content, and then also toward the more tundra, bog-like environment, which horses are not well suited for. So
nothing for them to eat there.
For them to eat.
Probably hurting their feet too.
The last few may have died out at that point in time. I think there's studies still ongoing, but there's been a fair bit of work done along those lines. That was a fairly interesting development that they were here as early as 7,600 years ago,
right.
And because everyone thought that the horse was introduced to the Indians from horses that came from Europe, and now maybe that's not the case.
So the theory was that the Spaniards and people like that brought the horses over, but there may have been horses here that entire time on the North American continent, we think?
Perhaps. They died out at a certain point, but that early Indians may have had horses that were native to this continent. We certainly know that the horse developed on this continent and then moved across to Asia, mm-hmm. and that a lot of horsemanship and most horsemanship apparently developed in Asia.
So that's I guess if you go back in the old cave paintings, you can see cave paintings of horses that are thousands and thousands of years old. And this certainly speaks to a fascination with a horse that the human race had for all that time. And perhaps, I don't know if they were capturing them at that time, but if you go back to these old paintings, you'll see amazingly beautiful renderings of these horses and other animals as well.
That's true. I think in France, there's some amazing cave paintings of horses. For many, you know, many generations of people throughout the world have used the horse. I think it was probably a difficult task because the horse is a flight animal, and domesticating the horse had to be a pretty big chore.
A flight animal is an animal that is afraid it's going to be eaten by everything that is
around,
like the smallest jackrabbit to the largest cougar is the sort of thing that will...
Everything.
So that's, I guess a moose is kind of similar in some ways, and is liable to be as startled as a horse can be. But I've been surprised at how little it takes to get a horse upset and have it suddenly run out the other direction.
Yeah, a shadow.
They have to be worried about. They're just like big freezers full of meat is what they are.
To the tiger.
On the hoof, to a tiger. Or, do you see a lot of problems with bears up here in horses?
We have occasionally seen bears that have been attacked by horses. Not often. I think it probably happens more in areas where horses are out on maybe in hunting areas or something. Uh-huh. But we don't see too much. But
there's a lot more bears around than there used to be when we were kids. That's my impression.
No kidding. That's changed a lot. I know in the years that after the earthquake, we lived up on Rabbit Creek, and I would go riding all over the hillside and never see a bear. And now everybody reports seeing them all the time.
Yeah,
so.
I've seen them walk by my house, and there's horses. We have a horse, and there's horses like across the street. And I think, boy, if I was a bear, I'd be kind of interested in those.
Yeah.
But it seems like they are more interested in garbage and stuff like that.
I think so.
Easier pickings.
Yeah.
So, we've got a question now from another caller. Roy, you're live on KSKA.
Oh, hi, Pete. It's Roy Corral.
Hey, Roy, how you doing?
Pretty good. I just thought I would call. I've actually been interested in the Norwegian horse and why they are so adaptable to the north, and I just wanted to find out with a good doctor and get her advice on that. And I'll listen to the radio.
Okay, thanks for calling, Roy.
So the Norwegian seems to be, I agree, the Norwegian seems to be very well adapted to our environment. And I honestly don't know that much about the development of the breed as a breed to know why that is the case, but they're short and stocky and have great hair coats and tough feet, and that seems to do well here. So
is that an old breed, or is it?
I can't tell you. I honestly don't know. And there are thousands of breeds of horses, and it's kind of hard to know.
It's like dogs. There's so many different breeds, and they have all these different functions. But it just seems like something called a Norwegian would do well up here. You expect that, although. You go farther north in Norway before it gets to be as cold as it does here. But do you see a lot of different breeds in your practice, or is it?
We do. We have. I didn't look at how many different breeds, but the majority of the largest number of any category is the American Quarter Horse. But I think that's true around the world. There are well over 2 million quarter horses in the world. And I think that a few years ago, the Quarter Horse Association, the National Quarter Horse Association, listed something like 1,400 or 1,500 horses that they knew for sure lived in Alaska.
1,500 horses in Alaska?
Of the American Quarter Horse. Yeah.
Wow.
I think that the estimates of the number of horses in Alaska varies greatly. There are reports from anywhere from 2,400 to 17,000. And I know for sure 2,400 is way too low. I don't know if there are 17,000. There are well over 2,400 just in Anchorage, I'm sure.
Right.
And then the other breeds are just widely scattered of different types. Every conceivable breed you can imagine.
So, what is a quarter horse? Is that what people think of as a regular horse, or?
Well, yeah, in some ways. The American Quarter Horse is a breed that developed in the United States that's a basically a stock, bred to be a stock horse, work cattle. They were originally a fairly solid boned horse with a lot of muscle. They developed for speed, for chasing cattle and that sort of thing, and now they have a variety of uses, and popular perception of the breed has changed the breed somewhat over time, just like it has any other breed. The breeding programs change to sort of suit what seems to fit the judges' desires for what they see in the show ring. But it's still a very, very popular breed and a nice, quiet, usually a nice, quiet horse that is very versatile.
Mm. So I think owning a horse is different than owning a dog or a cat. It's not so much like a pet in some ways. It's almost a lifestyle to have a horse. Do you notice a big difference between your small animal clients and your large animal clients?
I don't know that there's a big difference. I think it's a huge commitment, a much, much larger commitment than owning a dog or a cat, both financially and time-wise. When we were talking earlier about providing just the task of providing water for the horse every day, and then when you consider that most horses are going to eat about 20 pounds of hay a day, that's a lot of hay every year. And right. In Alaska, that costs a lot because a lot of our hay is shipped in from the lower 48, and so the price is necessarily very high. And so it's a big financial commitment. It's a big animal, so you need a big space to put it in. And they have to, just like any other animal, they need regular daily care and exercise. And maybe walk the dog for half an hour in the evening, but the horse, you know, you're going to have to probably spend more than like a couple hours a day with them. And so it's a bigger commitment. It definitely is a lifestyle.
That's the spending time with the horse is not just riding it. It's also cleaning up after it and getting its food and everything like that. So
yeah, picking the poop for a horse is a big chore.
Yep. And so how much does a horse need to be ridden for every day, do you think?
Well, I think that a horse doesn't necessarily have to be ridden every day, but he should have exercise daily for probably at least 20, 30 minutes of good exercise, or he just has to be turned out in a uh-huh. field where he can exercise himself and move around.
Mm-hmm. How much room does he need to exercise?
Oh, if you weren't going to get the horse out every day, for instance, most of our clients keep their horses in boarding facilities and visit the horse every day, and the horses are out from anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 hours or more, and getting daily exercise and probably a day off in there. But and so those horses are getting more than enough exercise, and they have pens that are adequate for them to, you know, be able to move around in and get out of the wind and weather and have shelters. But the horse that is kept out in a field probably needs a half acre, maybe, if that's all he's kept in. That would be the minimum. Certainly a couple of acres would be great, but it just depends on where you're at and what you do with a horse. I think if you're going to keep a horse in a smaller area, you really need to be committed to getting him out.
Okay, we have an email question for you. It says, Dr. Gross, I would like to get a horse. I live on an acre and a half. I am fascinated by Friesian. Do I have to have enough? This is exactly what we're talking about. Do I have to have enough room to keep a horse happy? How many could I comfortably keep? I don't want an only child, it says. Is this a good breed for Alaska? And what should I do to get myself and my property ready for a horse? And the final part is there a good way to find specific breeds up here? And so that's a number of questions there.
Okay. The Friesian, there are Friesians in Alaska, and they seem to do quite well. They're a little bit larger horse. In terms of being able to keep a horse on an acre and a half, it's certainly attainable to do that. The significant thing about your property and being able to keep a horse is that you have adequate drainage, and that you have the ability to provide shelter within that. And, of course, you have to comply with all the zoning rules that exist with regard to where you are. But I think that horses definitely are herd animals, and they like to be with other horses. One of the problems you run into if you get two or three horses is that if you want to ride one and you take that horse away, he's such a herd animal that it gets a little challenging to be able to go for a nice trail ride on that one horse and leave the other two behind.
Because the horse wants to go back.
The horse wants to be with his buddies, and the ones that are left behind are calling to him. And so it's not.
This is heart-rending.
It's a little hard, and you have to consider the safety of the horses left behind and that sort of thing. But it's also doable to have just one horse, and you become his herd, and it's okay. It works.
So they will bond with humans the way they would with a horse?
They will bond, definitely, to the person that feeds them.
So we have the only child question. I just want to make sure we didn't miss. We said that it's a good breed for Alaska, Friesian, and that's a large horse, I guess.
They're generally a little bit larger. They were, I think, the Friesian that comes out of Europe was originally a war horse. They're a beautiful animal, and they have a really wonderful personality and lots of hair. They have the big feathers on their lower limbs, and they're just a really wonderful animal. Researching the breed is in order. I think they do require special care, and you have to be very careful about their nutrition and care for them properly. But I've seen many of them thrive very nicely here.
So do you still keep horses yourself?
I don't. I don't have any.
That's too bad.
Yeah. Well, I get them. I get to be around them every day, so it's okay.
You're getting your horse fixed by fixing other people's horses,
yeah,
I guess. So I wonder, these are kind of tougher times economically. We've talked about a horse being a big commitment financially. Is it a little harder for people right now? Do you see more horses in distress because it's harder for the owners to take care of them? Or
I don't know that we are necessarily seeing more horses in distress. I do know that people are being more careful, and they're shopping a little more carefully for their source of hay and that sort of thing. I think there's been a little bit of a downturn in participation in horse shows with the economy, but I haven't necessarily seen much of a change in horses in distress. That seems to happen more when we have a really tough winter, or if we've had a bad year for growing hay and there's a little bit of a shortage locally of hay here in Alaska, because there certainly is hay grown here. Mm-hmm. But if we have a bad growing year, then it's a little bit short in supply, and then there seems to be a little bit more of a problem. Or if the price of hay generally around the world goes up, then when the price goes up here, I think it's a little tougher for people. That's the biggest expense, is really feeding the horse.
They're hay burners, I think.
That's what they are.
And they're literally hay burners, because that's what keeps them warm, I guess, in winter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that helps.
What you're talking about earlier with the horse's sort of internal combustion engine there.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about not knowing how many horses there are in Alaska, but there are groups, you said, that are in contact with people that you see a very few number of horses in your practice, but there are groups out there that will care for horses.
There are groups that are out there that definitely will help folks provide care for their horses. The Alaska Equine Rescue is a group that's been around for many years, and they are available to help folks that are having trouble caring for their horses, and have even taken horses in and cared for them with homes, that people that are willing to help out and take care of a horse, and then will actually adopt those horses out to other people if someone can't take care of them. But they've been very instrumental in providing care for a large number of horses and providing education for people to learn how to care for their horses. Sometimes it's just a matter of getting a horse and not really knowing what you're getting into, and just not having enough knowledge to know that the horse needs certain things, and this group does a really good job of providing that education and care.
That's going to be a very steep learning curve if you didn't know much about horses and you decided you were going to get one. I would caution people that a horse is a lot of care, and that you got to know a lot about it. And it's the sort of thing that you acquire knowledge over time as you have experience with the horses.
There's a lot to learn. I think that, you know, spending time with people that have horses and learning to ride and learning to handle them, and maybe even leasing a horse first before you buy one, just to really know what you're up against and be prepared for that commitment, because it is a huge commitment financially and time-wise, as we've said, and caring for that horse properly.
So let's see here. If you had your dream horse for Alaska, what would it be?
A dream horse for Alaska. You know, everyone has their intended use or what they really enjoy doing with the horse. There's so many different avenues to enjoy a horse. Anything from just having a pleasure horse that you can go down the trail with to high-powered jumping horse that you show and compete with. And so everybody seems to have a different, a different area of enjoyment with the horse. And so for me, I have a passion for riding dressage. And so I would, if I was going to get back in it, I would have a nice big, probably Trikaner or Hanoverian warm blood horse out of, you know, that was originally bred in Europe and had the kind of movement that went along with competing in dressage. So that's my dream. But
And we just sort of touched on zoning. What sort of zoning issues are there for people if they're thinking about having a horse in the city here?
Within the municipality of Anchorage, there are certainly zoning issues where there are areas where it is not okay to keep a horse, and that there are then also the requirements, for instance, for different subdivisions that do or don't allow for livestock. There are some rules with how many horses you can keep on a given piece of property and that sort of thing. So it's just important to check and see what your zoning is and what the rules are with regard to that, and then also subdivision rules. I think the most important thing, of course, is any runoff from the horse affecting neighboring wells and that sort of thing.
Right.
is a very important issue.
How do you deal with an issue like that?
I think just again, it relates to keeping that pen clean and keeping things picked up, and then that the drainage is appropriate and that it's not affecting anyone's well. I mostly just keeping the property picked up and proper manure disposal, and there are lots of avenues to take care of that.
Well, I know it's useful for gardens and things like that. There's got to be people around that would want to just manure is. It's only a problem if it's in the wrong place, I guess.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. It's not too bad for the garden, actually.
No. Now, you brought some numbers in that you were going to share with people about taking care with the horses.
Sure. With regard to our Alaska horses and nutrition, I think that there's a point that we can make about vitamin A and vitamin E. It's very important to provide additional levels of those vitamins for our horses.
Okay, and it sounds like we're going to have to wrap up here. I'm sorry that we have to go so soon because there's probably a lot of things we could talk about horses, and we can maybe come back to that sometime. But thanks very much for coming in, Dr. Julie Gross. It's been a great hour, and I would like to remind people that Hometown will be off next week for the Thanksgiving holiday. But to be sure to tune in the Wednesday, November 30th, when your host, Shelley Wade, will talk to you about winter driving on the next Hometown Alaska. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Dave Waldron engineered today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter Dunlap-Scholl.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.